this is my chief worry as a conservative, that we have put so much power in the office of the presidency that someday the wrong man could come along. And I wouldn't be so concerned about whether he could use these powers to perpetuate himself in office, but how he would use these powers to destroy people that disagreed with him.
I am very willing to let the American public judge my physical and mental fitness. So today, I applaud China for stepping up, I applaud Canada.
Government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed, by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
Responsibility, and here to discuss that in part with us, at least in terms of constitutional responsibility, is Professor John Harmon McElroy, professor at the U of A, professor emeritus at the University of Arizona, and he has took his PhD from Duke, I believe, and right?
Yes.
And he has taught for many years in several countries, and he has written 9 books, and is a local Tucson treasure. And his topic today is about constitutional amendments. John McElroy, the microphone is yours.
Thank you. The first thing I want to do is to wish all the mothers who may be listening a very happy day. It's especially appropriate, in my opinion, that mothers be acknowledged with their own day, same as fathers. But mothers especially are the, not only the mothers of their children, but they're the center and reason for human families in every society.
Keystone.
And that's something we should never lose sight of.
I agree.
Okay, what I'm really going to be talking about this morning is the condition of our country and how it got that way and what can be done about it. So I've bitten off a very big subject here, and we should get down to it right away.
Do me a favor and pull that mic downwards a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, that's good. Because when you look down, it goes away from it. And all right. But it doesn't want to stay.
It wants to go up.
Well, you know, the problem is that they never let go of their subscription to Viagra. I think it's the middle one, the middle one. Just to, right in front of your face there, John. Turn to your left. Right there. Straight ahead. No, turn to your right. There, right there. You're looking at it. That's the one you need to loosen and then tighten. So if loosen it and tighten it, and then that'll work. I'll come in there and get it. You tell you what, I'm going to turn my mic off. You just work on your topic, and I'll fix it for you, okay? Just have a seat, relax, and enjoy, and get to your topic. I'll fix
okay.
it. I'll come in and fix it for you.
All right. My director here, Charles Heller, is going to make sure that the microphone is properly placed here before we get too far into the program.
Let's go ahead with that topic.
But I'll fix it for you. Basically, I think what's happened has happened to our country politically, in our government, over a period of many decades, starting noticeably back in the 1930s during the so-called Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, there was a government policy that affected obedience to the Constitution. It was called the New Deal. And the economic suffering of the people of the states was so severe that in the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that is, they thought that really the Constitution was not as important or as material, as relevant to what had to be done as had formerly been the case before the 1930s and this great economic disaster, this crisis in the country. And they called this very appropriately the New Deal, because it really was a New Deal. Never before had the Constitution been ignored by, you know, the government of the United States. But that was the case during the Great Depression. And during the Second World War, which followed shortly after the Great Depression, the argument from necessity, that is, we've got to do something, continued to weaken adherence to the Constitution, as did also the four decades of Cold War, as it was called, with the Soviet Union, which began just a few years after the end of World War II in 1945, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was the formal military treaty that the United States led and entered into, was in 1949, and that was the, really, you might say, the official beginning of the conflict that was known as the Cold War. Now, in the 1960s, a very important development took place. This was during the Vietnam War. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the Soviet Union or the USSR, opened an anti-American propaganda front inside the United States to destroy the extraordinary confidence that Americans had then in their way of life. And this confidence in Americanism, in American culture, in the beliefs that had been formed during the centuries of American history, both before and after our independence from Europe, this was something that had very great impact on the thinking of people in government in this country and on Americans generally. The Cold War was a very much of a crisis for American culture because of this propaganda front that the Soviet Union opened inside the United States to destroy the confidence Americans had in their culture, which was the main source of their unity and strength as a nation. The founder of the Soviet Union invented a combination of incessant propaganda and agitation, you know, street demonstrations, arsons, various kinds of physical intimidation. And he called it agitprop. And in the early part of the 20th century, Lenin used agitprop to transform the imperial Russia, which was the largest contiguous empire in human history, to transform that into what he wanted, which was a totalitarian regime ambitious for and active in establishing communism worldwide. And in the new government that he created, he in the new government he created, he put a bureau of agitprop in the government to develop and apply this revolutionary technique to taking over other countries. And in the 1960s, long after Lenin, of course, was dead, his brainchild, this revolutionary technique called agitprop, a combination of agitation and propaganda, was brought to the United States. And I happened to see firsthand the effects of this on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, where I had my first university teaching job. The activities of the student left on that campus were very intense and had a lot to do with my wanting to bring my family here to the University of Arizona to teach because it was just so unpleasant at the in Madison, Wisconsin.
On that note, we'll pause.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You'd get some good bargains on the swap shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice, and have Charles make fun of your stuff.
Constitution, Constitution, the law that's supreme across the Union. Create a new state in the land we adore. Congress must agree, reads Article 4. All these states work together, yes, the Union is one. A brotherhood to protect from invasion. Article 5 could be wide, this work has survived. It says we can change it to keep with the tide. Two-thirds of the House and of the Senate, plus approval from the states, makes a new amendment. Every judge and every court must understand, Constitution is supreme, law of the land, and elected officials must agree with this list, bowing to an oath, part of Article 6.
And welcome back. Discussing said constitution with us is Professor John McElroy, picking up on the idea of agitprop and how it became a tool in the United States to help destroy the confidence of people in their system. John, go back to it.
Yeah. This propaganda front inside the United States that the Soviet Union opened in the 1960s was in the height of the Vietnam War. This was the second war in the 20th century, of course, that the United States had engaged in East Asia, in the case of Vietnam, Southeast Asia, in order to halt the march of communism around the world that Lenin had set as the primary foreign policy of the Soviet Union when he founded it. Now, the general tone of this propaganda, or themes, you might say, was that Americans are and always have been greedy, imperialistic, racist, hypocritical, undemocratic, materialistic, and socially unjust, to name the main ideas of the propaganda movement.
Yeah, and those are the good parts.
Yeah, right. And that was manifested, the general anti-Americanism of the 60s and the 70s was manifested to me as a young professor, as I said, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
But they had a great canoe rental program.
Well, I suppose you might say that. And in 1991, as we probably most of us remember, you don't have to be very old to have been aware of what was going on in the world in 1991, the USSR completely came apart. It disintegrated 67 years after Lenin founded it. And by that time, this propaganda front had been in operation for 30 years, and it had made great progress. It had made great headway. And the momentum that it had survived the Soviet demise. Some American academics had even become admirers of Marxism's claims to be scientific and Democratic, which required them to ignore two salient facts, two big facts. The domestic terrorism, which Lenin had created as the way to control Soviet society during the revolution, which put the communists in power in Russia, and the way the Soviets conducted elections. A Marxist election took me a long, long time to understand, but it's the same everywhere I've ever been where communism ruled the roost, namely in Cuba, where my wife is from, and in Poland. In a Soviet or Marxist election, every voter must vote. It's in the constitution of the country. That's true wherever you care to look in the Marxist world. When an election is held, the voters must vote. So that, in combination with two other basic facts, is the nature of a Marxist election, a Marxist democracy. Every voter must vote, and only the Communist Party gets to nominate candidates for office. And the party nominates just one candidate per office. That's what I couldn't understand. Why do they go to the trouble of this, going through this charade of calling this kind of thing an election when there's no choice at all involved?
For the useful idiots.
That's right. It's simply to get adult people, citizens of the Marxist regime, to affirm the choices that the party makes for them as to who shall be in the government. So that's those indications, what went on in American academia in the 60s and 70s and is still going on today, full throttle, is a sign of the symptoms of what is wrong in our country. We are under alien influence. We are under the influence of Marxism.
Can I ask you a really quick question, or do you want me to shut up for now?
No, go ahead.
I want to ask you, do the demonstrations that you see that are pro-Hamas on the campuses today reflect that same pattern?
Well, in that the demonstrations in favor of Hamas are pro the enemies of the United States and are designed to strengthen those enemies, yes, because that's what the agitprop movement in the 60s and 70s was designed to do.
Appreciate it.
And how much progress they've made. When I think back to my childhood and the years of the, I was born in the Great Depression, years of the Great Depression, and I grew up during World War II, and I had an older brother who was in Europe fighting, and my father was the executive officer of the 134th Field Artillery Battalion in the 89th Infantry Division in Europe. So I was a member of that generation which can remember the actual events of World War II. And this is something, what I'm talking about today, has a certain personal meaning to me. So these were all symptoms, what I've been talking about, what happened on our campuses and the takeover of some of the campuses like Columbia, in the 60s as part of the war protest movement. All of that was designed to destroy the culture of the United States, which is the kernel, the heart of America's strength and unity. And this is something that we ought to understand completely and understand the implications of that. And from my childhood in the 30s and 40s to the present day is a world of difference. It's no longer the same country that I was born into, and a lot of Americans who are in their last years of life feel that same way. Some of you that are listening to my remarks may also feel that way. So,
with our demographic, it might be most of them.
So the thing that we should keep in mind is that the agitprop propaganda plus agitation that was introduced in the United States very deliberately in the 60s and 70s has gone on to great success, because are we not divided in many, many, many ways, institutionally divided in this country? Our two major political parties are worlds apart, for instance. Okay, now the thing I want to dwell on for a while here as a sign of the condition the country has reached, the Marxification, we might call it, the sign that is perhaps most notable is called the administrative state. Now, a lot of you have heard of the administrative state. Others of you who are listening this morning have never heard of what that is, so we have to dwell on this a little bit. This is an example, an instance of what has happened in the United States, the crisis that we're in. Article 1, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution plainly states, and that I want to quote the entire thing, it's a very short section of the Constitution, and it's the first thing you read after you pass the preamble. Quote, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. But at present, thousands upon thousands of unelected bureaucrats are turning out untold numbers every day in Washington of regulations which the judicial, excuse me, my voice is a little hoarse this morning, which the judicial and the executive branches of the government are requiring the people of the states to obey as if they were laws legitimately enacted according to the Constitution's most fundamental requirement, which is that elected representatives of the people of the states shall make the laws of the United States. That's not happening today under this condition that we call the administrative state.
John, let's pause at this point, and it's a good natural point for a break, and take the bottom of the hour break, and then we'll come back on that point, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop.
Bunker is so funny. Is he married?
Bunker, call back.
It's Bunker, and I'm single, and I'm looking for a rich widow with a large ranch.
I've never even been on online dating. I believe in meeting people the old-fashioned way, alcohol and bad judgment.
She sounds like your type, Bunker. Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and our posterity do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
And that indeed is the stated purpose of government in the United States, something I harp on constantly, and something that John McElroy is going to expand upon further when we left off about what can be done. John?
Well, I was still, thank you, Charles. Mm-hmm. I was still talking about the dilemma or crisis that the United States finds itself in now. This is a process that's been going on for more than half a century now, and it's reaching the point where we have to do something about it. And I think I understand the situation well enough to propose what that something could be, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Now, Congress is that is to say, the legislative branch of the federal government, as well as the other two branches, the executive and the judicial. Congress's legitimacy consists in adhering to the Constitution. It has no legitimacy unless it applies and obeys the strictures on it that the Constitution contains, and which the people of all the states have approved. Now, let's take a moment to understand and really appreciate what that means. When the Constitution was ratified in the 1780s, after it had been written and presented to the Confederation Congress, and the Confederation Congress had sent it out to the 13 states that then existed, when that happened, over a number of years in the late 1780s, each state approved or ratified the contents of the document. But that didn't end there, of course. In the Constitution, it describes how states, new states, shall come into the Union, and they had to agree to live under these provisions. So they went through their own ratification process. And all 50 states now in the American Union of States have approved of this document. I mean, it belongs to the people of the states. It doesn't belong to the administrators who find their way to Washington, D.C. It's not theirs to do with what they please. It has to be adhered to and followed by those administrators because the people of the states have approved the provisions in it, and they have agreed to live under those provisions.
That's an impediment to the administrative state.
Yes. There's a direct conflict. The administrative state is the contradiction of everything the Constitution stands for. Now, Congress under the Constitution has absolutely no authority to invent new ways of making laws. They have only the obligation to obey the way that the Constitution says the federal law should be made. All of legislative powers, I remind you what the wording is at the very outset of the Constitution, all legislative powers shall be vested in Congress. And of course the writers of the Constitution saw the legislative branch that was created by election in the states, sending its representatives, elected representatives, to Washington to perform that vital function of making laws that represented the interests of the people, that they, the constitutional authority that the people gave that body of legislators, was seen by the writers of the Constitution as the most powerful of the three branches of government. So it's proper for us to be focused this morning on the corruption of the legislative branch. We hear a lot about the corruption of the judicial branch and the executive branch, but it's really at the heart of our dilemma today is the corruption in the legislative branch. Now, it's not, Congress is not, as I said, empowered constitutionally to reproduce itself, to clone itself, so that more federal laws can be made than it could possibly produce just by itself. Congress has also failed in allowing that to happen. Congress has also failed not to do it in doing its duty to uphold the Constitution by allowing the president, no matter who the president is, Republican or Democrat, both parties have done this, to issue executive orders that Congress allows to have the weight of federal law. So not only has Congress unconstitutionally created laws, but it has allowed, you know, the other branches of government and the judicial branch has gone along with us over the years. So we are in a real predicament, a real dilemma.
I have a term for this, by the way.
Yes.
I call it sickle cell government growth.
Well, that sounds pretty interesting.
And it's led
you
to
want to elaborate on that?
What happens is it leads to a metastasis of government. It not only multiplies in its authority, but it multiplies in the speed of multiplication. Right. It multiplies factorially. Back to you.
Okay. I think that's a good description because the sickle cell anemia is fatal or can be a fatal disease, and that's what we're talking about here. But the writers of the Constitution, in their great wisdom, contemplated and discussed what to put in the Constitution to deal with something like we're facing today. That is, when the federal government is so corrupted, so has departed so far from the provisions and prohibitions and principles of the Constitution, that it cannot be entrusted to properly conduct the government that the people of the states have ratified. So they put into the Constitution in Article 5, the part of the Constitution that deals with amendment changes to the Constitution that may be needed, along with the power of Congress to propose, under certain conditions, to propose amendments. They also provided for a convention of the people of the states to come together if 2/3 of the state legislatures ask for such a convention to propose constitutional amendments. And that's what we need today. That's my solution. It's not mine personally. It's not original with me at all. It's a movement that's been going on in this country. Excuse me again for my hoarseness. It's a movement that's been going on in this country for a long time. And we are far from arriving at the 2/3 approval of the states for such a convention. But that's what the purpose of my remarks this morning are, is to convince more of you as fellow citizens to see that this convention of the states needs to be held. It's time the states called a convention of the states, because we need a new sort of Congress. If we can purify, so to speak, if we can restore Congress to its constitutional authority, then we stand a good chance of Congress reforming the other two branches. Now, the Congress we need is a Congress that's more, the way I put it, grandchild-oriented. That is to say, more oriented to the future, to posterity, than it has become. Congress has deteriorated into simply reacting to the situation of the moment, and I must say, honestly, that there's a good deal of graft, a good deal of congressmen using the powers of Congress for their own personal gains. And it's time that be addressed. And the way to address it, obviously, is to get rid of the qualifying ages for election to Congress. 25 years old for the House, 30 years old for the Senate. Why do I object to those? Because as long as those are in place, Congress members can be elected very early in life. They may not be elected in their 20s and 30s. They may come into the picture in their 40s and 50s. But they're in Congress for a long, long time, longer than they need to be, long enough to be corrupted by this pervasive...
It's a very corrosive atmosphere.
It's a very corrosive atmosphere, yes. And we need to have a convention of the states in order to address this particular situation in Congress.
Shall we leave that as the jumping-off point for the start of the next segment?
If you say so.
Well,
Mr. Producer,
we
go
have
ahead.
We have a clock, so,
okay.
You know.
Yeah. Well, how much time do we have?
You have until the bottom of the next hour, so you have 45 minutes left in this.
Okay, I think we can do
We'll do that.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country, and Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Earth to JD, did you disappear on me?
He's calling on the next line.
Hey, how about now?
There's a specific phrase we use to get the caller back.
Give my caller life!
And look at that, he's back.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
This great country of ours is in a heck of a shape. And don't let your heart be troubled. We got the right man working for us. So pull out your Bible, blow off the dust. We need to pray to the Lord.
Indeed, we need to pray to the Lord. And a man that's not adverse to that at all, John McElroy, is here talking with us about the solution based on Article 5 of the Constitution on how to right some of the mess that we're in. John?
Yeah, we need to change the age at which congressmen are elected so that it's impossible for any of them to stay in throughout their adult lives or most of it. Because that's the way, as you and I agree, Charles, before the break, that's the way staying in office too long, way too long. Is a way that things get corrupted, because the longer you're in office, the greater the temptation is to substitute your own authority for the authority of the Constitution.
Boy, you want a great example of that, Senator McCain.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
there's
he was a phenomenal man with great integrity who just over a period of time let the system get to him. He wasn't corrupt personally. About power.
Yeah, how many times have we discussed, I mean, not you and me personally, but Americans have discussed with fellow Americans that, gee, that guy we elected to Congress has sure changed since he got there.
Right.
The swamp effect, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the first thing. We need to get an older Congress, one that's more grandfatherly, so to speak.
Maybe we could get Geritol to sponsor
the older our representatives in Congress are, the more mindful they will be of what's going to happen to the country after they're gone, to their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Mm. I myself happen to be a great-grandfather five times over. So I'm very sensitive to this particular need. So we need an older Congress, one that can't be in office throughout their lifetimes. Secondly, we need to change the way Congress is paid. Because in this country, who pays you is your boss.
Mm-hmm.
And the way things are right now, Congress is its own boss. They really don't have any final obligation to the people of the states because the people of the states don't pay them. We need to change that. We need to change the way things are now, where Congress decides what its proper compensation, its proper benefits are. And that should be taken out of the hands of Congress and put in the hands of the states that elect congressmen. For whom they work. The people that pay, that they work for, should pay them. And finally, as I've already indicated, I think that the time in office, well, I haven't actually said that, I've implied it, the total time in office, not just when they, how old they are when they get into office, but the total time they spend in Washington, the less of that, the better. And I suggest 12 years. Let me read what I've written on this head, the change.
8 minutes till the top of the hour. Go.
Okay. This would be my way of addressing these particular difficulties, and they are addressable. They can be fixed. A vote of two-thirds of the governors of the states assembled at a time and place of their choosing other than the District of Columbia shall have power to impeach any elected or appointed officer of the U.S. government on evidence that they have violated a requirement of this Constitution or a law enacted under its authority. The chief justices of the states, likewise assembled, shall have power to remove a governor-impeached officeholder if two-thirds of them find the evidence substantiates the impeachment. The oldest state governor of longest service and the oldest state chief justice of longest service shall preside over these respective proceedings. And they and their fellow governors and chief justices shall be under oath to defend the integrity of the Constitution of the United States, and their judgments shall be final. If the office is elective, a replacement shall be made by election within 3 months of the removal. And finally, this section, this amendment, I think should have the following section in it. Persons removed from office for violating the Constitution they have sworn to uphold shall be deemed unqualified to hold further office under the United States or a U.S. state or territory and unfit to vote in state and federal elections. Costs incurred by a state in carrying out its responsibilities and duties under this new provision of the Constitution shall be reimbursed from the U.S. Treasury. Now, this amendment makes sure that the people of the states, makes clear, that's what I meant to say. This amendment would make clear that for the people of the states, obedience to the Constitution that they have authorized is a fundamental, long-term, permanent interest of theirs and defines what would happen to any federal office holder whose actions show that they do not share that interest. So that's the heart of what I would like to see a convention of the states propose, that a new impeachment power, impeachment and removal power, be given to the people of the states, and this power would be exercised by the state governor, whom all the eligible voters, that is, of a state vote for, just as the Senate, which also plays a part in the impeachment, the House of Representatives, they bring the impeachment charge. And just as the governors of the state have more authority than any member of the House, because members of the House are, elected by districts, whereas a governor is elected by the people of the whole state. Yeah. Right. And the Senate, which under Article 5, not under Article 5, but I forget.
Article 1.
It's
Article 1 when the power, they're the ones that try an impeachment.
Yeah, they try the impeachment.
They stand as a trial court where the House sits as a grand jury.
Yeah. And the Senate, which acts in the way that Charles just said, under the Constitution, to try the impeachment that the House brings, would be replaced in this provision of the Constitution, this new amendment, would be replaced by the Chief Justices. And I propose to you to think about this, that the 50 state Chief Justices, I think, are better positioned through temperament, training, and experience to sit in judgment on impeachment charges.
I wouldn't disagree with that statement. I mean, most of them tend to be, like, for instance, I know one of the justices on Arizona's court, Mr. Justice Bolick, Clint Bolick, and I've known Clint for 30 years, and I think the man has, he's not the Chief Justice, but I think the guy has tremendous judgment and insight.
Mm-hmm.
To give you to reinforce what you said, but I don't want to slow you down. We got exactly two minutes left to the top of the hour, and then we'll. By the way, folks, we're going to continue this for 2 hours. The last half hour, I'm going to invite everybody to call in, deluge us in the last half hour with your opinion. I'd love to give John's voice a rest in that half hour.
Yeah, well, if you have a real question, I'd be glad to discuss it with you, but don't take Charles's invitation to mean that. Call in with some question that you...
Right, exactly. Yeah, minute and 30 left.
Okay. Well, we might as well take the break now because that's the main part of my presentation, my main point, as to how the Constitution could be changed to completely reform our federal government and make it Constitution obedient, because it isn't now.
Okay. Well, then, on your mark, AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. Stay tuned for America Armed and Free.